Hello and welcome to the Spike podcast. I'm Fraser Myers, and back with me in the studio after a short break, we have Spike's editor, Tom Slater.
Hello.
And I'm delighted to welcome for her Spike podcast debut, it's Talk TV's Julia Hartley Brewer.
Hello, lovely to see you. I listen to this podcast. Honestly, it's an absolute must every single week, so it's an absolute pleasure.
Thanks so much for coming on. Coming up on today's show, we'll be discussing the government's crackdown on extremism, the ban on puberty blockers, and the People's Revolt in Ireland. Before we get into all that, I just wanted to remind you about the very exciting event we have coming up. Matt Ridley is joining Brendan O'Neill live and in conversation on Zoom on Thursday, the 21st of March. If you're a Spike supporter, you can sign up now for free. And if you're not a Spike supporter, now is the time to become one. Being a Spike supporter is the best way to support this channel, to support everything we do at Spike, to keep us free and accessible. Plus, you get a whole load of exclusive perks like free events. You'll also get discounts in our shop. You'll be able to comment on articles and you'll get ad-free browsing. So none of those pesky full-page adverts taking up the space. Really, it's you're joining a like-minded community of Spike fans and supporters. So it really helps us out. To find out more, just go to spiked-online.com/supporters. That's spiked-online.com/supporters. So this week, Michael Gove has unveiled a new definition of extremism. This is in response to some of the quite open sort of Islamist extremism that's been on display in recent marches and demos. Tom, do you want to just walk us through a little bit what is going on here? Because it's quite confusing. I think a lot of people don't quite understand.
Tom.
Well, I mean, we could start with what it's not, because I think there's been a lot of hasty commentary this week as if to say that Michael Gove is about to criminalise various different groups, to prescribe them various names that have been mentioned in Parliament this afternoon, from the far right Patriotic Alternative through to CAGE, a kind of infamously Islamist link, shall we say, being legally circumspect group. That's not what's happening. What this is really about is trying to tighten up the definition of extremism to stop predominantly kind of government and potentially in the future kind of other arms of the state from funding, meeting with, doing business with, being advised by organisations which might previously have either been extremist themselves or had a slightly concerning kind of high tolerance for various extremists, platforming them, etc. So the definition is centred around extremism, hatefulness, intolerance, promoting violence, promoting the replacement or overthrow of British liberal democracy. It's not being placed on like a statutory footing. It's effectively a kind of set of guidelines, but it will undoubtedly have effects on what central government is supposed to do. And whilst it hasn't kind of married up with the, as I say, quite kind of hasty assumptions about what this would mean, it still has the potential to be very chilling where freedom of speech is concerned, because of the fact that it's effectively a kind of blacklist is being drawn up, and it's suggesting that these institutions are not to be dealt with. Currently, it says there's exemptions where things like universities are concerned, which are obviously going to have a higher premium on freedom of speech. But first of all, it only says initially.
Really?
Well, should be in theory at the very least. Let's not add to the censoriousness. It says initially, but even if you think about a university, what kind of vice chancellor is going to happily allow a group which has been branded extremist by the government to speak at a student event at a university? So the potential here for chilling of freedom of speech is quite profound, even if it's not about prescribing these groups directly and locking them up, etc.
Yeah, and Julia, I mean, isn't there just an inherent problem with the word extremism? You think an extremist, what?
Yeah,
can't
exactly.
We all be extremists?
And hate and intolerance, all of these words seem to mean very different things to different people. I mean, I think we're all extremists and hateful and intolerant to an awful lot of people, because we know we're the people in the right, that's what they are.
Yeah.
but it's very strange, because I was talking about this on my Talk TV show, and I had lots of guests on who are experts in this field who were all saying completely different things. And I'm left with this view that I am both sort of completely nonplussed by this. Like, what's the point of it? It doesn't, as you say, it's not criminalising people. It's not going to actually do anything. It doesn't even stop, even though it stops government funding these organisations and allowing them to work with the government or get appointments. It doesn't stop, you know, local government or any other NGO or any other organisation and all those quangos that still have millions of our taxpayers' money to give to them as well. So you think, well, what's the point of it? And at the same time, I think it's really bloody scary. I don't think that Michael Gove is someone I want to decide who is an extremist or not. And people are saying, oh, well, it might be okay with this government, but, you know, if a Labour government get in, well, it was this government that decided during lockdown to monitor in a secret units, including army units, what me, other journalists, scientists, medics, democratically elected politicians were saying and doing and writing online. My name and my details were passed to a counter-terrorism unit in the United States. I had to go legal on them to get actually a formal apology because they branded me a known vaccine skeptic. Now, this was for simply doing my job as a journalist, completely openly questioning government ministers on my show and tweeting and writing articles. And yet they thought that was so subversive and dangerous. It had to be monitored and then information sent to a foreign government. Do I trust these people to decide who is intolerant, who is hateful, and who is extremist? No, I don't.
Yeah. And Tom, I mean, I guess the flip side of this is that while, you know, the potential for abuse is absolutely enormous, you know, treating people as extremists for just asking legitimate questions. On the other hand, there is a broader sort of denial of actual extremism, Islamist extremism,
absolutely.
For instance.
No, definitely. I think the two have gone together. I thought what was really interesting about the turn of the commentary in the past 24 hours is that the line that seems to be taken by the liberal left is, but the real extremists are the Tories, aren't they? Mm. Which on the one hand demonstrates the kind of denialism that you're talking about, people desperately wanting to point to one spicy comment Suella Braverman made as if it's somehow the equivalent of the pro-Hamas protests we've seen on our streets. But also demonstrating the problem that we're getting at, which is extremism, at the end of the day, is kind of in the eye of the beholder.
Yeah.
It is something which is a subjective definition, unlike something like terrorism, which is a bit easier to pin down. This is not something which you can easily define. And when people like Miriam Cates have raised the example of gender-critical feminists, it's a pretty good one insofar as if you look at the definition that has now been implemented, it talks about hate, it talks about intolerance, it talks about violence. These are words which are constantly levelled at gender-critical feminists.
Words of violence.
Violence, exactly. Yep. Even genocide is what they've laid at their feet because they deny the identity of trans people, etc. And also, it's not just Michael Gove making these decisions. He's set this definition, but it'll be civil servants, it'll be various
famously neutral and independent.
Exactly. Famously conservative in their instincts, famously anti-woke.
I don't even want necessary trans activists whom I completely vehemently disagree to be labelled with this. Yeah. It seems to me, you know, either what you're doing, it's the same with the non-crime hate incident. Mm. Either what you're doing is illegal or it's not. Yeah, we've got to stop having this grey area. If someone is a threat, if someone is doing something, they're inciting violence, they're encouraging violence, they're threatening to commit violence, then arrest them, put them behind bars. Here's an idea, build some prisons so you've got some prison places to put them in and stop letting people out early. I mean, these are really basic things. But if someone is simply, I think people should be entitled to be intolerant and be entitled to hate. A man is entitled to hate women, in my view, in this country. That's freedom of speech. I would like to know who hates women, because then I can debate with them and argue with them and expose them. And you know. But we need to have a more, you know, an environment where people can be open. But if you cross the line where you are a threat to other people, then you will certainly face arrest and trial. But we don't have that because we see threats every single day on the streets of London, you know, to particularly to Jews currently. But also we do see anti-Muslim hatred as well. We see against women or black people, whatever. And action isn't taken.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I mean, ironically, you know, we saw at the weekend, the Met Police decided to take some action against some protesters. But it was against an anti-Hamas protester, against someone who said that Hamas are terrorists.
Literally official government policy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, no, apparently he was arrested because of assault. No, he's on video, someone grabbed his poster. And again, fighting back against that isn't assault, that's self-defense. I personally think that every right-minded person should be going on those marches and standing there holding a big sign saying Hamas are terrorists.
You know, they can't arrest all of us.
Yeah, free the Palestinian people from Hamas. If you disagree with that, you're on a hate march.
I mean, it did prove that the point that these are hate marches and full of extremists. They're not the fact all. That people they're, got so... No, they're not
there
all.
There will
the
be
that,
a lot of people who are genuinely concerned about children in Gaza. Mm-hmm. Didn't care so much about the children in Yemen or in Iraq or in Syria. They don't care much about, you know, Uyghur children. They're very specific in the children they care about, though. Have you noticed that?
They've only got so much time, I suppose, say. But the police thing is interesting because there has been this genuine issue with various wings of the state kind of dealing with supposed community leaders who turn out to, if not be extremists themselves, have some quite nice things to say about extremists. We saw that with the Metropolitan Police. They've had to get rid of at least two advisors recently who are on their kind of London Muslim Communities Forum, because one of them led a spirited rendition of From the River to the Sea, and another one of them had previously praised the founder of Hamas.
Yes.
Easy mistake
to make.
Exactly. Who hasn't?
Which of us can hold our hand on our heart and say we've not praised the leader of Hamas?
We were all young once, you know. Yeah. But and so this is a genuine problem. Incidentally, the definition currently won't apply to the police. But it's a reminder that, yes, there is this problem with kind of capture of state institutions or too much influence via various different groups. That could be charities, that could be supposed community leaders. Surely the answer to that is to just get rid of that whole layer of the kind of multicultural state. So we had set the law and the policy in conversation with elected representatives and the people, but we're not here to take our lead from people who just set up an organisation and claim to speak on behalf of all Muslims.
And I'm fascinated by all the money that goes from government and local government and NGOs, as I mentioned earlier, to these organisations. Why are we giving all these organisations money? What, I mean, you know, why does Snowball get money? Why do various, you know, Muslim groups get money? Why are all these groups getting taxpayers' money? Why isn't that money just being spent on, you know, giving people operations for cancer and teachers? I think most people will be horrified to discover the huge sums of money that of our hard-earned money that ends up in the pockets of these organisations. And I'm not sure what any of them actually do.
Or if they're too good or acting against the common good all too often.
Maybe the best case scenario is they don't do bad.
Yeah.
That's our best case scenario.
At Spiked, we know that plenty of you would love to break free from the usual 9-to-5. Imagine finally doing things your own way. But we also know that starting a business is difficult. Luckily for you, there's a way to make it easy. And it sounds like this. Yes, that's the sound of another sale on Shopify. The groundbreaking all-in-one commerce platform that gives you the power to be your own boss. Shopify empowers up-and-coming entrepreneurs like you all over the world. Whether you trade digital clocks or homemade clogs, Shopify can simplify how you sell goods both online and in store. Running your own business has never been this easy. Shopify brings your whole business under one simple dashboard. This makes shipping and managing goods absolutely effortless. That means you'll have all the time you need to focus on the big picture. Shopify also connects your business with social media marketplaces, from TikTok to Instagram. Regardless of who you're selling to, Shopify will help you reach them. Don't worry about getting lost in the crowd either. Shopify's simple customization tools give you the freedom to adapt your image. What direction you take remains completely up to you. So what are you waiting for? If you want total business independence, get started with Shopify today. Sign up for a £1 per month trial period at shopify.co.uk/spiked. Go to shopify.co.uk/spiked to take your business to the next level today. That's shopify.co.uk/spiked. This week, the NHS England banned the use of puberty blockers to help essentially gender-distressed children. I mean, for years there's been discussion about the potential side effects of these drugs. I mean, the NHS has finally come out and said that we can't even account for either the safety or the efficacy of them. I mean, why did this not happen sooner? How did it go on for so long, Julia?
I'm a mum. I can remember being chastised for giving a double dose of Calpol to my baby, for God's sake. You know, your advice, don't give children anything. Their bodies, their brains are developing, you know, within the womb. And even if they're 12, only half a paracetamol. Oh, no. Oh, you're 14, you're a bit confused and upset, you've maybe got autism, you may or may not have been abused, or maybe you're gay and you just think your parents are homophobic. So, yeah, absolutely, let's give you drugs that will completely alter your body, completely alter your hormones, your brain, damage your brain bone density, may well give you liver cancer. That's fine, because don't worry, it's just a temporary thing. Now, one thing we know, what happened at the Tavistock Clinic and other clinics that do this, that actually it's pretty much a one-way street. You get on the puberty blocker, well, you turn up at these clinics the next day here on puberty blockers, and then you are on a one-way track to the most horrific kind of changes to your body, self-mutilation. I mean, you know, cutting off healthy breast tissue or cutting off, you know, healthy penises and things like that. I'm sorry, that's body mutilation. Yeah. We wouldn't allow people who said, I didn't like my right arm to cut, we wouldn't go around cutting their right arms off for them. It's no different.
You wouldn't tell someone with anorexia, yes, you are really fat and we'll help you.
We should actually help you lose weight. Yeah. I mean, that's the thing. And that is what this is. There are no such things as trans kids. There are kids who are confused and mixed up and who need our help. And these clinics were not doing that and have not been doing that and are still not doing that because Tavistock is still open right now today. It's just down the road from me, and so I'm very aware of that. No, but this is the problem, is that they've known all this time these were experimental drugs. 20 years ago, clinicians at the Tavistock were saying, be worried about this. What do we know about the long-term impacts? And they didn't care. No other treatment would be allowed. No other treatment would be allowed. People die of cancer because a cancer treatment hasn't been tested far enough. Mm. But no, that's fine. Give these drugs to perfectly healthy children. This has been one of the biggest child abuse scandals of our time. I'm certainly glad. I know you two and me, we've been on the right side of history on this one, in largely being in favour of not mutilating children and ruining their lives.
Yeah.
But it is extraordinary it's taken this long. And by the way, it's all happened under a Conservative government who ostensibly in charge of the NHS and allowed this to happen under their watch for so long. And I think shame on everybody involved.
Mm. Yeah, I think, you know, even just hearing just some of the basic facts about puberty blockers, you know, the brand name is Lupron. It was developed to stop prostate cancer, essentially, not something that young children suffer from, usually. It's also the same drug and the same dose, incredibly, that they give to paedophiles when they want to chemically castrate them.
I mean, that's got to be a good thing, then, hasn't it? Giving that to a kid. Also, rendering them infertile. And unable to ever achieve any sexual gratification, no orgasm. Yeah. You can't, at the age of 14, consent to that.
No, exactly. And that's something which has been surely obvious for some time, and yet the refusal to own up to that. How can you have a child who hasn't even gone through puberty yet to consent to a treatment pathway which leads on to another treatment pathway, which will effectively end with, again, not being able to have sex in the usual way, not being able to kind of experience those natural feelings? It's the sort of thing where you think you're expecting them to consent to something which they have no kind of concept of whatsoever. You're often leaning on parents, has often been the example, you know, kind of blackmailing them to go down this particular path, otherwise, you know, they're going to kill themselves, these horrendous, spurious kind of emotions.
That's like, not borne out.
Exactly. Mm. All complete nonsense. And the other thing is that up until we went down this ridiculous road in relation to medicalizing children and sterilizing them under this idea that they've got a mismatched gender, all of the data pointed to the fact that experiences of, whether you want to call it gender dysphoria or just gender confusion or whatever, the cure to it is puberty, basically. That's something that you saw that tended to be young boys in particular who would have these this feeling, this anxiety, this sense of incongruence. But as they would go through puberty, that would alleviate as they sexually matured, as they entered into relationships, etc. And they often turn out to be gay. So what we've ended up with is basically taking away the cure to the gender dysphoria and also sterilizing and converting young gay kids in particular. Yeah. It's a horrendous mess. I think the fact that the NHS have made this kind of emphatic statement, introduced this ban, is really telling of how strong the evidence is.
Yes.
Because I imagine the higher-ups at the NHS would have done anything to keep this going.
Only the CAST review would have made this happen, and that was, what, 2 years ago?
Well, this is exactly,
but again, they would have loved to have said
it's actually fine in some circumstances. The fact that they couldn't, I think, speaks volumes.
I find it very difficult sitting next to someone so transphobic. I mean, why are you not in favour of mutilating children and ruining their lives? Why not? Why don't you care? Why are you dehumanising? I mean, you know, but it's still available in Scotland, it'll be available in Wales, also in private clinics. Now, that is going to be a really big issue. I mean, because actually an awful lot of this is happening, and it's the middle classes who just sort of play along with all this madness and go along with it, and the schools that are doing this. I mean, I live in North London, I've got a teenage daughter. This stuff is rampant. It is absolutely rampant. Girls are watching this stuff. And again, it's interesting how it went from being a small number of men to being a huge number, thousands of teenage girls, particular social contagion in particular schools. One girl, there's a lot of, you know, troubled girls obviously unhappy about their sexuality or unhappy about sort of the over-sexualization of the world around them. I understand that as well.
Their
bodies, gender, and just looking at YouTube of some girl who's slashed her breasts off and has said, "Oh, look, now I'm happy." I mean, that's where that level of stuff, that's how these girls are being influenced. It's just so beyond obscene that this has been allowed to happen, and the adults have not been in charge, and the parents, the medics, all the people who are supposed to keep children safe have failed them. My thing about this is I need people to be prosecuted. We have got to start having more actual accountability and not just, we're closing you down. You had no right to ever do this. You know, I'm a daughter of a GP. First do no harm. They first did harm. And anyone who carried along with it when other people were blowing the whistle or were resigning from the Tavistock and elsewhere, and you carried on doing this stuff, I'd like you prosecuted.
And Tom, I mean, I just wanted to raise that question with you. You know, where were the adults in all this? How did people get dragged along with it? Why did they think it was more important to follow the word of activists over medical evidence?
Well, it's difficult, isn't it? Because on the one hand, there is the problem of capture, as we often talk about, because of the fact that you've had institutions like WPATH, which I know you spoke about in the podcast last week, which was trusted as this, you know, kind of masqueraded as we are the group that deals with this.
I assume
evidence.
They were these experts.
No, exactly. The fact that they're just a kind of an array of trans activists that you might naturally encounter on social media is very telling. So there is that kind of sense of, you know, of course, people who work in the NHS, they can't be an expert in everything. They're going to refer it to the clinic that's devoted to it. They're going to look at the guidelines, which have been drawn up by these supposed experts. So there's a lot of that going on. And I think people didn't quite realise how deep the rot runs.
It was their job.
It was. And I think, especially when you're talking, when concerns started to be raised, the fact that this wasn't taken seriously was absolutely outrageous. I think particularly what I find so unpleasant about this is the whole kind of trans kids thing has been pushed so emphatically, particularly by older trans activists, often trans themselves, because what they feel that they need to kind of justify their cause by saying it's naturally occurring, it's actually much more widespread than you think.
Yeah.
And so in a sense, these confused young people have been sacrificed at the altar of this agenda.
Yeah.
And that's the most disgusting thing about it, I think, is that you've got older individuals who are basically exploiting some quite troubled young people for the sake of furthering their own cause and burnishing their own sense of themselves.
Yeah.
And it's, aside from the medical scandal involved and all the rest of it, that real kind of moral depravity is something that I don't think we can.
I think there's also an element, I'm not in any way saying this is the majority, but I still think there also is an element of the trans ideological activist where there is also a much more depraved aspect of this, of keeping children looking like they're pre-adolescent. And I'm sorry, that's something that is going to be coming more to the fore as it comes forward. The, you know, the hatred of women, the desire for children to look like they're prepubescent. There is a strand, and it's only a strand. I'm not in any way saying trans people are paedophile. I'm not saying that. Categorically, I'm not saying that. But there is a strand among the activists, which very much is so. And you can see this easily on social media in terms of what they're pushing. The justification, was it minor attracted
person.
People? I mean, things like that. You know, sorry, we have a word for that. It's called paedophile. Mm. I think there is something much more sinister going on as well among some strands of this.
So the Irish people have given an enormous two-fingered salute to the establishment. The government has been defeated in two referendums, one around changing the meaning of the family, another wanting to remove references to women's role in the home. And they've been defeated very, very comprehensively. Let's have a look at what the Taoiseach, Leo Varadkar, had to say.
Taoiseach, were you surprised by the result today when you launched this campaign? Were you confident that the amendments would pass?
Certainly when we launched the campaign, I was confident that the amendment would pass. But having been involved in the campaign for the last couple of weeks and talking to a lot of people, certainly in the last week or two, I became increasingly concerned about the CARE referendum in particular. I thought we were in a stronger place on the family referendum. But clearly I was incorrect. And I think if we ever needed proof positive that opinion polls don't predict the outcome of elections and referendums, we have it now once again. They might tell you what people thought a week ago, and they don't tell you how people are going to vote in a few days' time.
So, Tom, I mean, it's giving an indication there that actually, you know, all the polls were saying that, yes, we're going to win in both referendums. The entire political class obviously supported the yes referendum.
It's all very familiar.
All the NGOs supported yes in both the referendums. But it didn't work out that way.
No, it's a story as old as time. It's
like at this point.
That was 2016. It's so, no, yeah, at least it's old as time. It's so fascinating. I mean, I think it was one constituency which voted yes, but only to one of the measures. It just, the chasm between all of the political class in Ireland and the voters is so stark. And it is a reminder of the string of referendums we had in recent years. Obviously, there's Brexit, of course, which people talk about it as if it's a close-run thing. First of all, it was the 52% was the biggest democratic mandate ever. But also, you know, we talk about these things on a constituency level. If Brexit was a general election, it would have been like north of 400 seats. It was a very emphatic win, which is why 2019 happened. Similarly, I think is also really reminiscent of the Australian referendum recently on the voice to Parliament, where you basically have not only that consensus, but also the sense of condescension towards ordinary people. And it's just fascinating at a time in which particularly now, politics feels very much on the kind of cultural terrain. You know, it feels like particularly amongst the kind of mainstream political parties, they don't disagree very much on those issues, and they kind of want to impose this agenda from on high. But not only is there a big gap between them and the public, there's also this growing resistance. You know, there's also, even though there might, even in this particular referendum, you look at some of those wordings, you think, would people care that much? Obviously they did, because they rightly intuit the sense that they're having an agenda shoved down their throat, or that their values are being redefined from on high. And even if, you know, some of the wording in a constitution that's been around for, you know, knocking on for 100 years might be a little bit outdated here or there, there's obviously a bristling against that, and long may that continue with it.
And yes, Julia, I mean, you know, it's so obvious that if you're talking about, I mean, a lot of people have said this kind of referendum on woke.
Yeah.
And if you ever ask the public about any of these woke ideas, you know how they feel about it.
Well, they've asked them publicly, or if they can actually just do a vote and then they don't.
That's true,
you know,
that's
people
won't
say all the right things, and they'll pretend they care about net zero as well. I have to say, if I were involved in this referendum, I would have, as a woman, wanted to change about women's duties in the home.
Yeah.
Hello, husband, if you're listening. but I mean, certainly the definition on the family. It's the idea that, you know, there are many different forms of family. We've been told this so many times by so many people, particularly on the left, about, oh, there's so many different kinds of families. Yes, and the one that works best is the one where two people are married to each other. And it doesn't matter whether it's a man and a woman, or two men or two women, but that the one that works best for the couple and for the children, crucially, is the one where you are married to each other. And it's absolutely crazy that that little piece of paper means so much. But as a married woman, I know it does, and the stats bear that out. So it's crazy for governments to say, well, lots of people live differently. Well, that's fine. That's their choice. But I don't think we should be idealising that as a good thing. But the other thing about this that was fascinating was, you're holding a referendum on changing some words in the Constitution, which my guess is most people had no idea about in the first place anyway. Is life in Ireland right now so idyllic, so perfect and pastoral? The lambs are gambling away. Everyone's got money coming out of their ears. They can have the heating on all the time because life is so cheap. Food plentiful. Everyone's got the job they want. Is life so wonderful that the Irish government has got time to waste the energy, resources, the bandwidth of government on such an utterly pointless, meaningless, ridiculous referendum? Apparently, yes. Let's all move to Ireland. It sounds bloody great over there.
Well, I mean, maybe it doesn't sound so great. I mean, thinking about the way that Ireland does seem to sort of embody a lot of the worst of woke in many ways. I'm thinking a little bit about the, you know, the recent hate crime law, for instance, Tom. It's like they've swapped one religion for another quite quickly within the space of a few decades.
And it wouldn't surprise me if some of those other sorts of policies and acts and measures which have been coming through helped kind of galvanise more scepticism of these particular changes, not only because some of them might have struck them as a virtue signal, not only because some of them will have obviously disagreed with the changes in themselves, but also this kind of sense that there's this kind of, not just in Ireland, but Ireland, as you say, is a pretty clear exponent of it, this desire to kind of socially re-engineer your own public, like their values aren't correct, they need to be brought up to date. People really don't like that. They don't like being lectured. They don't like being told that they're really backward. And I think it's just another reminder of how important referenda are in this in this particular age, particularly when we've got representative democracies which aren't very representative. These opportunities to either just land a blow against the political establishment or demonstrate how big the gap is in terms of values and ideas and
Well, Frank Parodi wrote a brilliant article for you guys on this on the Spiked website about the reaction of the elite, which was very similar to the reaction to the Brexit vote. Which, well, people didn't understand the question. They literally said that. It was very badly worded. Yeah. And, you know, the campaign wasn't very good. Again, whenever we get it wrong as voters, whether in Ireland or Britain or France or Denmark or anywhere on Brexit, we didn't understand. I don't know why they bother troubling our pretty little heads with these silly things. But I'm with you. I would like more referendums. Again, I think there should be a referendum on things like, you know, like net zero.
Yeah.
I mean, let's think. This is a major policy about, you know, affecting every aspect of our lives and our economy, basically to impoverish us and take us, re-roll back the Industrial Revolution. Do you think we might have a vote on it?
Would be nice, not least because it has almost taken on quasi-constitutional significance.
I tell you what would be nice as well, though. I mean, wouldn't it be nice in this country if we did have a constitution whose words we could alter?
Well, yeah.
So we actually had an idea of what we stand for. I'd love to have a referendum on that, because the left would be flabbergasted, to include the left of the Tory party, by what we actually really think are our values.
Well, yeah, I mean, it would be nice to have free speech enshrined in the Constitution. It would be nice to have, you know, more referendums enshrined in the Constitution. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I can't see them giving us that anytime soon. Yeah, I think after Brexit, that was our last chance. Yeah, they're not, exactly. They're not going to let us have a say
again.
I mean,
it was bad. It's bad enough they're going to have an election this year, you know.
I say it was nice to see the Irish elites accept the result of a referendum.
Yeah, that's true.
Which hasn't always been the case.
Well done, then. A lesson for everybody.
Well, thanks, everyone. Thanks, Julia, for coming. See you soon, hopefully.
Thank you very much. Well, I'm only going to come back if I can just steal another one of these spiked mugs. I think you guys should sell these. These are amazing. They're really nice. Would you not want to buy one of these spiked mugs, everybody? Cheers.
Cheers.
Thank you for listening to the Spike podcast. We're back every Friday and you can now watch us on video too. Check us out on YouTube or go via the Spiked website, which is spiked-online.com. See you next time.